It is Thursday, November 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Belgian authorities launch raids on terror suspects. We get perspective from an analyst. Terror casts shadows over the APEC and ASEAN summits in Asia, and country music star Carrie Underwood has a new hit album, Storyteller. It's all ahead. Events are evolving in Europe, particularly in Belgium, where there are currently raids underway by authorities looking for militants who are possibly involved in last Friday's attacks in Paris. I'm joined by Professor Rick Coolset of the Department of Political Science at Ghent University. So, Professor Coolset, how do you think authorities know who to look for in Belgium, these various raids that are now underway in Brussels?
Well, the raids which are now on the way are only partly linked to the attacks in Paris. In fact, there are six searches going on, house searches, and only one is directly related with one of the persons which are still being looked for, be it in Antwerp, Brussels, or Paris. So there is no clue about one of the perpetrators, which is still, well, not known about. The other searches have to do with the Belgian foreign fighters who have left Belgium for Syria in the last 2 years. So there is no direct link with the Paris attacks.
Okay, so these are just, they're looking basically for cells for involvement of people that are involved in militancy.
Yeah, so what is now really a big insecurity and so a potential threat is the amount of individuals who have been involved in the Paris attacks. So the number is still unknown, and so yesterday we've heard the news that there was a fourth cell of at least 6-7 people who were preparing another attack in Paris. So it is this uncertainty for the moment that creates this atmosphere of panic, and really boosting activity by police and governments for the moment.
And there have been a number of militants who are connected to Belgium, including the man who had been called the ringleader, Abdel Hamid Abaoud.
Yeah, that's right. He seems to be also in the picture by the American intelligence services for quite some months. He seems to be the link between IS back in Syria on the one hand and a kind of kinship and friendship network or networks in the plural in Belgium and in France. And so this ringleader has been involved apparently in a number of failed attacks in the last couple of months in Belgium and France. For instance, the Thalys train where the attack was stopped by the American heroes, but also a number of other failed attacks. And now this Paris attack of Friday was unfortunately the first successful attack by this network. So it is a combination of grassroots sympathizers back in Europe on the one hand and IS operatives working closely together with these grassroots operatives or sympathizers in Europe.
Are there concerns within Belgium itself about an attack taking place there following the attacks, the recent situation in Paris?
Yeah, quite clearly, the Paris attacks have been a kind of a wake-up call for everybody. As far as you can judge from public available information, there are no concrete indications that there is an attack being planned or prepared on the Belgian soil. But really, as I said, it is this uncertainty about the amount of individuals and about the plans that the surviving members of this gang or this network might still harbor. It is this which is driving as well the panic, as well as the activities and the repression which we now witness in Paris, Belgium, but also in Holland and in Germany.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Professor Coolset. That is Professor Rick Coolset of Ghent University in Belgium. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
China on Thursday joined Norway in condemning the killing of one of their citizens who'd been held hostage by the Islamic State militant group. I'm joined now by VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide. Bill, what has been the official reaction to this?
Well, there's been strong condemnation. There's been calls for more international cooperation. And China has also pledged to bring those who carried out this act of violence to justice. The question, though, is how will they actually go about doing that? As many know, China's position in the Syria conflict has been one of advocating a political solution to the problem. It has rejected the use of violence. China has a foreign policy of non-interference that it largely uses in most of its dealings with other countries and other conflicts and situations like that. So really, the question is how or what will come next.
Yeah, and I guess there are really kind of no indications of that so far.
There are no indications, only other than their past practices. And as I mentioned, analysts that I've been speaking with today have said that really it does not seem likely that China would get involved militarily. Although one did say that, you know, you couldn't rule out the possibility that because of what Russia is doing in Syria now, and that aim of that effort is to stabilize the regime, that possibly, you know, China might consider doing the same, you know, bombing positions in Syria. But that, I think, would be a huge adventure. And as another analyst pointed out, taking on taking its first venture into that kind of a military effort would be pretty difficult to take on Islamic State. And given the fact that other countries have struggled so far to deal with the problem.
Could there be any domestic implications as well in regard to China's Xinjiang province? There have been incidents, cases of radicals, you know, conducting violent activities there and also elsewhere in mainland China.
Well, definitely Chinese government, that has been their message starting from last week with the horrible attacks in Paris. They have been talking about how there's a need for international cooperation. And when they say that, they mean that the international community needs to cooperate with it to deal with the problem in Xinjiang and to deal with what it sees as a spread of religious extremism there. The problem is that the situation in Xinjiang is not necessarily as cut and dry. While there's obviously been incidents that would be defined and were clearly terrorist attacks and the killing of innocent civilians, there's also a very heavy program that China has going on in Xinjiang of oppression of religious and cultural practices of the minority Uyghur group there. And there's been a long history of the Chinese government not sharing a lot of information about the attacks when they happen. In some cases, attacks are suppressed for months or weeks on end before we know anything about them. So it's hard, and this is kind of what analysts were saying to me today, it's hard for other countries to engage with China on this when they don't have a complete and clear picture of what's going on.
Well, thanks very much, Bill. That's VOA correspondent Bill Ide in Beijing.
Glad to join you.
Well, looking at reaction on social media to terrorism is my colleague Susan Yockey, and she joins us here in the studio. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Sarah, everyone. Terrorism, in light of the attacks in France and elsewhere, remains a major topic of attention on the web. The lead story on the VOA website reports U.S. President Barack Obama said today efforts to defeat the Islamic State group will not succeed until there is a political agreement in Syria, and that he does not believe a settlement should leave President Bashar al-Assad in power. Nobody tweets, "My religion never taught me about terrorism, suicide bombing, killing innocent people, etc. I'm a Muslim." The Standard Digital says, "Funny how terrorism makes us religious and unites the world." Neil Morrow tweets, "The kicking time bomb beneath French society. The lesson? Ignore people and they'll get angry." Katie Kalabushish writes, "Why is terrorism the only thing we react this way about? Poverty, health, etc., all way more deadly." Network Guy asks, "So many of you out there are wondering why Saudi, Kuwait, etc. are not taking refugees."
Anything else you'd like to mention from the web today?
Yes, Sarah. This week, we're marking International Men's Day. The International Men's Day global website says objectives of International Men's Day include a focus on men's and boys' health, improving gender relations, prompting gender equality, and highlighting positive male role models. It is an occasion for men to celebrate their achievements and contributions, in particular their contributions to community, family, marriage, and childcare, while highlighting the discrimination against them. Leo tweets, "Mental health issues, emotions, traumatic events don't make you any less of a man. Your problems matter." Clearcano Flynn writes, "If International Men's Day is used to talk about the rate and prevention of suicide amongst men, then that is a good thing." Bia tweets, "You are important too, and you are worthy of all the good in this world. We love you." Sarah?
Thanks very much, Susan. That's International Edition Susan Yockey. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Did you know that not all fat is alike? White fat or bad fat, what we think of as body fat, is associated with obesity. But there's also brown or good fat, too. Unlike white fat, brown fat does more than just store fat. According to researchers, it actually burns fat. Now scientists at the Baylor College of Medicine in Texas say that they've been able to come up with a way to convert some of that nasty white fat into brown-like fat in mice. According to the researchers, the brown-like fat helps burn up white fat cells by producing heat, which in turn results in weight loss. They say the white-to-brown-like fat conversion is made possible by activating a thyroid receptor with a synthetic chemical compound they created called GC1. The researchers think that their studies might lead to a drug to help fight obesity. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, country singer Carrie Underwood has a new hit album. The threat of terrorism and tensions over China's island construction in the South China Sea have dominated the APEC Asian Economic Summit, which ended Thursday in Manila. Well, meanwhile, Malaysian authorities have deployed extra security in the capital, Kuala Lumpur, where the annual Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, will gather Friday through Sunday. Regional analyst and Australian-based independent consultant Carl Thayer tells International Edition's Victor Beattie, Asian leaders realize that extremism knows no international boundaries.
The concern is, I think, that there are hundreds of volunteers from Southeast Asia that have gone off to fight for various terrorist groups in Syria, and what will happen if they return. But so far, ISIL's targets really are the Assad regime, Iraqi regime, and Western countries that support it. But it raises the real possibility that tourists, businessmen, and business interests from those countries now involved in suppressing ISIL could be attacked in the Southeast Asian countries. And in Australia in particular, just before the ISIL attack, it was revealed in our press that ISIL was urging its followers in this country to specifically target uniformed police, uniformed military, and intelligence agencies. And we have one of the highest levels of terrorist threat in a decade.
The APEC statement says economic growth, prosperity, and opportunity are among the most powerful tools to address the root causes of terrorism and radicalization. How concerned are Asian countries that the Trans-Pacific Partnership a free trade agreement might not make it through the U.S. Congress?
I think they're very concerned. Quite simply, in a round of recent conferences that I've attended, including New Zealand, where I met with people who had negotiated the TPP, and then in Vietnam, where I met several Western ambassadors who were involved with that, if any one of the 12 countries other than the United States couldn't ratify it, the TPP would go ahead. But the TPP can't go ahead without the U.S., and this has been such a long and exhaustive process with so much horse trading, so much angst about what one's giving away and the benefits from this, that if the U.S. Congress didn't pass it, it would be a colossal blow both to Obama's prestige and the U.S. prestige.
Turning to the South China Sea, it's an issue that even though it's not really on the agenda of APEC, it was brought up by President Obama. He told China to stop its land reclamation in the region. It will also come up probably at the ASEAN meeting in Kuala Lumpur.
Well, it's going to certainly lead to sparky rhetoric, as we've seen from China, that considers the U.S. an outside power and it really is trying to sell the line that the U.S. meddling is the cause of all the particular problems. But I think that in a more subtle way, by President Obama raising it with President Aquino bilaterally and not at the APEC venue in the formal meetings, that China can take some consolation from that. But it should be remembered that in the past, when the South China Sea was first discussed, it was brought up at the APEC Summit Leaders Retreat, which was informal. And about 10 countries supported the United States at that particular point. So it can come up at the informal retreat and really not make it in its way into the public record. But in this case, handling it separately, that sends a message to China, but it also acknowledges that APEC should stay on the economic and trade liberalization path.
Well, Mr. Obama's comments notwithstanding, China is going to forge ahead with its own long-term plan, I would imagine, in South China Sea. What can Southeast Asian neighbors do about it?
Well, I'm about to go to Vietnam and address that problem, and the answer is their quest for a code of conduct has been already overtaken by events. And that the quest for a code of conduct is not the panacea that they think it is. China has made a fait accompli. The artificial islands are China's. They'll build the infrastructure, and whenever China chooses, they'll find an excuse. Already, they've said they will use defense threats as an excuse to militarize these islands, although Xi Jinping says he won't militarize them now. Southeast Asia is going to have to come to grips with the fact that its maritime heart has been slowly excised out of the maritime area by China.
That is consultant Carl Thayer. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Ever since winning American Idol in 2005, Carrie Underwood has been making and breaking records. Now, as a new mom with a newly released album, she's making history again. VOA Music's Nikki Strong is here to explain. What historical first has Carrie Underwood achieved this time?
Oh, man, she's achieved so many. But in addition to her countless awards, including 7 Grammy Awards, 17 Billboard Music Awards, 11 Academy of Country Music Awards, Carrie has an extensive history of number one hits and number one albums, not just reaching number one, but debuting in the top spot. So she just released Storyteller October 23rd. It was the highest selling debut week by a female country artist of this year. It has also made her the only artist in the 51-year history of Billboard's Top Country Albums chart to have all of her 6 albums debut in the number one spot, which is a major historical accomplishment.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, have other female country artists had their albums debut in the number one chart?
Yeah, so you've had Reba McEntire, Loretta Lynn, and Dolly Parton. They've all had you know, multiple albums, but they were not consecutive. So all of Carrie's albums, six to date, have debuted in the number one spot consecutively. If you go back to even Carrie's career, back the first, very first single of her professional career, Inside Your Heaven, back in 2005, that debuted in the number one spot on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, not the country chart. And she was the first country music artist to ever do so. That album back in 2005, Some Hearts, was the fastest selling debut country album in SoundScan history. It also became the best selling solo female country debut in the Recording Industry Association of American history and the top selling debut album of any American Idol contestant in the U.S. So that is how her career started, and she has been breaking records ever since.
Well, Carrie's also a new mom now and about to go on tour as well. Busy lady.
Yeah, she's about to go on tour in support of Storyteller. It starts in 2016, and it includes dates in the States, the UK, and thus far, Canada.
How has being a new mom impacted Carrie?
Well, of course, it's greatly enriched her life. She's become more grateful. She actually just recently posted an adorable Instagram video of her asking him for a kiss, and he slobbers all over her, and they're cracking up. It's very sweet. It's gone viral. She plans on taking him with her on tour, Baby Isaiah. And on her CD, Storyteller, she also writes a song about him. It is called What I Never Knew I Always Wanted, and it's already sliding up the charts, and it is definitely one of her most personal songs on the CD, Storyteller.
You can catch up with Nikki Strong on VOA 1 for Country Hits USA. You can also reach her on Facebook at VOA Music and on Twitter at VOA _music. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
Music of Carrie Underwood. That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 years ago, Burma's President Thein Sein and the ruling regime launched a series of reforms and relaxed press and internet censorship laws that opened the door to democratization. The government also released from house arrest Aung San Suu Kyi, the leader of the main opposition party, the National League for Democracy, or NLD. On November 8th, these reforms were put to their most difficult test yet, as the Burmese people went to the polls to vote in a competitive general election with over 6,000 candidates vying for more than 1,100 parliamentary seats. Election results show the NLD winning over 75% of parliamentary seats nationwide, including enough to control both houses of the legislature. The United States has been very focused on this election, said White House Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes. It is a critical milestone in evaluating Burma's democratic transition. The United States participated, along with many international monitors, in working to ensure that the election was credible and inclusive, that there was transparency, and that it reflected the will of the people of Burma. 25 years ago, Burma held a similar election, but the sitting government annulled the results. This time, the government has pledged to listen to the will of the people and work to transfer power peacefully. The State Department also recognized structural problems. On November 8th, Secretary Kerry said in a public statement, "While these elections were an important step forward, we recognize that they were far from perfect. There remain important structural and systemic impediments to the realization of full democratic and civilian government." Rhodes summed it up by saying, "We believe this sends a very positive signal that an election took place. The people's voices were heard. The authorities are committing and pledging to respect the results of that election." huge challenges remain in the country to complete the national reconciliation process with various ethnic groups and to address the humanitarian challenge in Rakhine State, he said. But if they can continue in the spirit of national unity, this is an enormous opportunity for the people of Burma. The United States congratulates the people of Burma on taking this great step toward democracy and commends all of the people and institutions in the country who worked together to hold a peaceful and historic poll that allowed the people's voices to be heard.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.